The views and opinions expressed in Cold and Missing are exclusively those of the hosts. All parties mentioned are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Cold and Missing also contains adult themes and languages. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, Allie McLaughlin-Sulkowski.
And I'm your co-host, Eli Sulkowski.
And this is Cold and Missing, where we cover cold cases
and missing person cases.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cold and Missing. I'm your host, Allie, and Happy New Year. It is 2025 officially. This is the first episode of 2025, and we're going to be doing something slightly different this week. Eli will not be joining us this week, but that's because I have a special guest. On today's episode, I had the honor of chatting with Ruby Hall, who is Elisa Roberson's sister. We're going to be covering Elisa's case today. And throughout the episode, I'll be sharing with you the conversation that I was able to have with her sister, Ruby. There's a lot of conversation that we had, so I think we should just go ahead and get into it. Episode 114. And just as a bit of a content warning, there will be several mentions of domestic violence throughout the episode. Today, we are talking about the missing person case of Elisa Roberson. And this takes place in August of 1989, in Aransas Pass, Texas. But first, a little bit about Elisa. And I think it's only appropriate to start with how Ruby remembered her.
She was the oldest one. So, of course, with that, she had some responsibility, you know, kind of watching over the us little ones. So she was always the one that kind of my mom kind of left in charge to, you know, if for whatever reason, if my mom was gone, it was always, you know, Elisa to make sure that we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. And even if mom was there and we were outside playing, or, you know, if we weren't doing what we were supposed to be doing, and Elisa told us, you know, mom said da 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 da, we just would automatically get scared, like, oh my gosh, she's going to tell mom if we don't listen. So, I mean, we weren't. We didn't always listen, and we didn't always do what we were supposed to do.
Elisa was born in Nicaragua. Her father passed away when she was just a baby, but her mother soon met Gene, an American man who worked in the shrimping industry. He had been sent to Nicaragua to pick up a boat when he met and fell in love with Marina. Gene will ask Marina and her daughter Elisa to come to the United States to get married. Soon after arriving in the U.S., Marina got pregnant with Ruby, Elisa's younger sister. Elisa and Ruby were only about a year and a half apart in age, and because Elisa was held back a grade in school, they were actually in the same grade as well. Elisa picked up English faster than her mother, so from a young age, she was able to translate for her mother. Over the years, Marina will have another child with Gene, a son named Tony, but eventually Gene gets in trouble with the police. He's involved in a bar fight that gets out of hand, and he ends up having to spend time in jail. With Marina on her own and vulnerable with three children, she ends up meeting a new man named Ralph. Ralph, at first, seemed like a good guy.
I think about the time Ralph came into the picture. I think that my first memories of him, I was about 5 years old, and I think that's about when he came into the picture. And of course, at the time, my mom didn't know. She was vulnerable. She was just in a vulnerable situation. But when Ralph came along, she didn't think, she thought he was a, you know, she didn't know his history. She didn't know that he was into drugs. She didn't know that he was a bad guy. She had no idea. He had actually, the way she said that, the way they met was somebody was actually, some guy was bothering and harassing her, and she was being followed by this guy who kept trying to be in a relationship with her, and she didn't want to have anything to do with him. And she said one time he was just kind of following her around, and she started running, and she didn't know where to hide because she was scared. And she said there had to be I guess Ralph probably was in his yard, or if I'm understanding or remembering right, he was in his yard and just told her to come in, you know, come inside my house. And then when the guy passed, he told him, you know, leave her alone.
But eventually, he ended up showing his true colors as an abuser.
Yeah, he was just really, really abusive, you know, really mean, the things that he would do to us kids. And then he would flip and then just be, it was just, he was, definitely a sadist. I mean, as an adult, I've realized he really liked to cause pain and he really liked to scare us. I think part of that game was he would do mean things to us, but then he would be nice.
He terrorized Marina and her children.
And then the things he would do to my mom, of course, like, I mean, he beat her. He beat her in front of us kids. And he would take her. There were so many times where he would take her, you know, he'd beat her and take her and the kids, all of us kids, and he would take her to places like under the bridge, far away, remote areas, all us little kids in the back seat. And he would be telling her, I can do something to you. Nobody will ever know what happened to you, and nobody will care to come look for you. And what more of a threat also to have three of your three kids in the back seat while they're threatening to kill you.
Marina will eventually have a child with Ralph as well, a little boy named Alex. But Ralph's terror, after years, would come to an end in 1989 when Marina finally is able to leave him for good. She and her four children lived on Whitney Street in Aransas Pass.
I just remember, too, like we just were always, you know, especially that summer, we were always riding our bikes and we're Gen Xers. We didn't spend a lot of time indoors. We weren't playing video games. I do remember Mario Brothers was just coming out, and that was fun when we would, my sister, her best friend had a Mario Brothers little PlayStation thing. And we'd go over there and play, but the main thing we love to do is just hang out outdoors and riding our bikes and going to friends' houses, and we didn't spend a lot of time indoors. Yeah, it was really fun because I remember when, you know, if there were kids picking on us, like you never had to worry. You know, we had our big sister and she, no matter what, she was always had our back. Nobody messed with us if Elisa was there. So she commanded some kind of respect being, you know, older one. And then she was also, you know, I didn't see it at the time, but look, she was very well liked, and so she was kind of popular. She had a lot of friends.
Elisa was funny and responsible. She was well liked amongst her classmates and the neighborhood children. She was protective of her siblings. And now, a timeline of events. On Sunday, August 6th, 1989, the night before, so that would have been Saturday night into Sunday morning, Elisa spent the night at her best friend Charlotte's house and then ended up spending all day Sunday with her as well. It was normal for Elisa and Charlotte to go to church together on Sunday night. They would take a bus that would leave around 5:15 in the evening. The bus would make rounds around the neighborhood and then arrive by 6 o'clock when the service would start. However, on this Sunday, Elisa made a last-second decision not to go to church that night and decided to head home.
We don't know that anything, you know, as far as we were concerned, she was just, you know, when she got home, she's like, you know, she told my mom, she just, didn't feel like going to church. And, to me, I just took it as she had spent the night and the whole day with Charlotte. And then she decided to finally come home. Maybe there was something else going on, you know, but Elisa didn't seem like she was upset or, you know, when she got home, she didn't seem upset or anything. She just seemed like, you know, she just wanted to come home.
Elisa is back to her house pretty quickly, and it's believed that she got there right around 5:30. Within minutes of getting home, the phone rings, and it's Elisa's friend, Debbie.
So when Debbie called, because remember, I was sitting there, Debbie says she didn't call her, but I swear to God, like, I was sitting on the couch, and the phone was right next to the table. Mm-hmm. And I was the one that night, with all the phone calls coming in and out, I was the one answering the phone because I was right there and the phone was right there on the side table. I just remember I was always answering the phone. So when Debbie called and she wanted to talk to Elisa, you know, Elisa said, hey, Mom, you know, Debbie wants to know if I can come over. And my mom, of course, initially told her, it's getting late. You just got home. Like, and Elisa didn't seem like she necessarily wanted. She was kind of like, the attitude was like, either way, didn't matter. So when Debbie said, you know, tell your mom I can meet you halfway, because she told her, Debbie, my mom said, it's getting late, and I can't come and play. And Debbie said, well, I'll meet you halfway. Tell your mom I'll meet you halfway and my dad will bring you home. And so that's when my mom said, okay, well, then if that's the case, then it's okay.
Debbie had another friend over that evening and they all three wanted to play together. Years later, it will be said that Elisa and her mother were fighting that evening, but Ruby does not remember a fight that evening at all.
There wasn't a fight, and this is where it just blows me away. Like, where this whole fight thing came from is just beyond me. There was never a fight. My
right.
mom and Elisa weren't fighting. There was no disagreement. The only thing that I remember was when my mom says, well, tell Debbie it's getting too, like my mom, there was like a little hint of annoyance. That was it.
She says that Elisa and her mother rarely ever fought. Elisa was an easy child and also hadn't really reached the teenager attitude yet. By all accounts, once the plan has changed, Elisa's mom agrees to it so that way she can go and play. She's more comfortable since Elisa won't be walking by herself and she won't be walking back in the dark. So Elisa heads out of the house. The exact time is unclear, but the family believes that it would have been shortly after 5:30, as Elisa hadn't been home for more than a few minutes before her and Debbie made plans to hang out.
It was just by chance that Elisa gets home, and within minutes, Debbie called. And I do remember vividly her getting a drink of water. I do remember her. I do. That's just so funny. Like, she got a drink of water. I remember it was hot, so she gets a drink of water. She goes to the bathroom. I remember her fixing her socks. It's just so surreal, like the little things you will remember. I just remember her fixing her socks. Like, you know how you fold a sock down?
Mm-hmm.
You put, you know, she was just fixing her socks, like folding them over, making sure they were straight, and then off she was.
When Elisa left her home, her older next-door neighbor saw her walking down the driveway as they were standing at the sink doing dishes. To get to the elementary school, it should have only taken around 6 minutes to walk there. Elisa would have gone north on Whitney Street and then head west on Goodnight Avenue. Right at the corner of Whitney and Goodnight Avenue lived the Pierces.
When she started walking, there were the neighbors on the corner, the Pierce
mm-hmm.
house. That was where her little boyfriend, on again, off again, little boyfriend crush Nathan lived. They were all outside when they talked to her. She was walking past and they talked to her, asked her, you know what, you know, hey, Elisa, what's up? You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm going to meet Debbie. So that could have taken like a couple minutes, you know, for her
sure.
to talk to them. They told us that she just didn't really stop, but kind of slowed down, talked to them, and then kind of just kept walking.
Others have come forward to say that they saw Elisa that day. Altogether, about six folks saw Elisa leaving her home and heading towards the elementary school on Goodnight Avenue. The school was a little farther from Debbie's house than Elisa's, so Elisa would have made it to the school first. But when Debbie arrives to the elementary school, Elisa isn't there. Debbie keeps walking towards Elisa's house and also runs into the Pierces, who are still outside. Debbie asked them if they have seen Elisa, and they said they had. She had just walked by a few minutes ago, headed towards the school. Debbie turns around and starts walking back towards her house to see if she can catch up with Elisa. Debbie walks all the way back to her house, and there is still no sign of Elisa. She wasn't at the school, en route, or waiting for Debbie at her house. Debbie then calls Elisa's home to see if she was there. Ruby answers the phone.
However amount of time it was, I don't know, but at some point then Debbie calls. I remember answering. From that point on, I was answering the phone. So Debbie answers. She wants to know where Elisa is. I remember thinking, okay, she's probably talking to a friend. I didn't think anything of it, and I was even annoyed at Debbie. I thought maybe Lisa and I were fighting, but I remember being annoyed, and I think maybe it was Debbie I was annoyed at, because I remember saying, I don't know and I don't care, Debbie. I'm not thinking a big deal about it, but my mom in the background, when she heard I was talking to Debbie and she's hearing our conversation, she yells from the kitchen, because she's in the kitchen cooking, and she goes, tell Debbie Elisa should be with her right now. And I kind of sense like there's like a little bit of panic in my mom's voice, like
mm-hmm.
that first onset. And Now, when we've been able to, you know, as we're talking, she said she knew as soon as Gabby called, that's when her panic, you know, kind of started set in. Me, I'm thinking maybe she's just talking to a friend. So we tell Debbie, she's not here. And then Debbie says, okay, I'm going to go back and see. Maybe I'll find her. I'm going to go back and look for her. And so she goes back. I don't know how long she was gone again. Then the second time she calls, that's when we start getting even more panicked, because then she called and said, I didn't, is Elisa there? You know, we went and looked for her. We didn't see her. And then she says, I'm going to wait when my dad gets home. I'm going to have my dad take me to look for her. Some time passes again. Then the next phone call, it's Bob Green, Debbie's dad. He wanted to talk to my mom. And so I give the mom the phone to my mom, and that's when he asked her, Mrs. Roberson, is Elisa home? And my mom said no. And he said, stay put, we're gonna go look for her. And so then at that point, I don't know how long, he could have been gone half an hour, maybe it was an hour, we don't know for sure. And then he finally, he shows up at our house and he wants to talk to my mom. He tells my mom, Mrs. Roberson, you need to call the police. I remember his panic setting in too, like, Mrs. Roberson, you need to call the police now.
It dawns on all the adults that something is really wrong here and it's time to call the police. The police are called at around 9:45 p.m.
I didn't know it until I got the police report that I was the one that made the phone call. So my mom had me call, and we asked, on the police report, it says, my sister hasn't come home yet. My mom would like a police officer to come and talk to her. And so then at some point, the police officer shows up at our house. It was just one that I remember. He talks to my mom and gets the report, and just kind of remember him saying, she's probably just caught up playing with a friend and has lost track of time, and maybe she'll show up and, let us know if she doesn't come home. It was kind of like just, no big deal. There was no urgency. And then that whole night, we were up all night. Between my mom and I, we were both up. I remember being up with my mom. I couldn't sleep. Like, neither of us could sleep. And my mom was pacing. She was looking out the window. She would go outside. She was just, there was just, it was just a horrible, horrible night. And I just remember always looking out the window and picturing her walking through the parking lot, like she's going to come walking up any minute now. Mm-hmm. And just thinking I was seeing her coming home, and she just never came home.
The next morning, Monday, August 7th, bright and early, Elisa's family is at the police station to report that she didn't come back that night. They run into Detective Lieutenant Linda Thompson, who is in charge of the juvenile division for the police department. Police protocol at that time said that any matter involving a juvenile, Linda was supposed to be called to help assist in the matter. The night that Elisa went missing, she was never notified. Detective Lieutenant Thompson immediately launches a full search in the neighborhood.
The next memory I have is there's detectives, cops, whatever you want to call them, in our house. They wanted to go through some of my sister's things. They took her diary. They took a hairbrush. They took some clothes. They took some shoes, a pair of shoes, a shirt, a couple items of clothing, and probably some other things. And I remember the brown paper bags. And so they wanted to get the dogs, Elisa scent, and I think they wanted her hairbrush for her scent, and then hair. DNA was still fairly new at that time, but you could still compare hair to.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. And so I remember that, and I remember the dogs. I remember the helicopters. I remember there were people. There were a lot of people. There were my mom's friends that came over, and my mom just couldn't sit home. So between her and her friends, we did our little search parties. And you had the foot explorers going here, the search and rescue. It was just chaos. It was just pandemonium, like people everywhere, and news reporters. There was so much going on and so much that was happening and that they were doing.
Scent dogs are brought in, and they are able to pick up Elisa's scent, and it tracks it down to the school, and then suddenly stops at the corner of 8th Street and Goodnight Avenue.
When the bloodhounds were, when they brought the bloodhounds down, the bloodhounds followed her scent a little past the school.
Police theorize that Elisa got into a car at this point, and her case is labeled as an abduction very quickly.
And it just became a blur. There was just, I mean, there's things I remember, but there was just so much going on, and just hoping and praying that you're, you know, that she would come home, that she would show up, that something would come of it. And I know for sure, talking to Linda, that this went on for weeks. You know, the search and rescue, there was a lot, and we were as a family too. We were as a family. My dad was, but I remember the initial boom of all the people and the chaos and the talking to the police, you know, my mom, us going to the police station, them coming to our house, my mom talking to them. There was quite a bit, and I just remember there were a lot of cops, seeing cops. I remember seeing a lot of, I guess they were search and rescue people around the town, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just in our area. You know, our house was a you know, a lot of people coming in and out, and our you know, family and, you know, friends. When I say family,
yeah,
my dad really was the only family, but my mom had some really close friends that we consider to this day, we consider them family. So when I say family, mm-hmm. that's what I mean. They were really good friends of my mom's, and a handful of them. And we did our, you know, going to the newspaper, getting flyers, passing them out, walking. I remember it being so hot and walking and being thirsty. I remember being so thirsty and just walking the whole town, just passing out flyers, asking people if they've seen my sister. And Linda, I didn't know about this, but they also had their family, a lot of, you know, her sons. And so there were a lot of people too that I wasn't aware that were helping us too.
Mm-hmm.
She said it lasted weeks where they were working 7 days a week. Then they kind of scaled down, you know, went down from 7 days a week to 6 days to five.
Mm-hmm.
To, it starts to slow down when you can't find anything.
After the month of August, police hadn't found any sign of Elisa besides her scent trail. Police switched gears from physical searches to working their way through all of the leads and tips that had started to come in about Elisa's disappearance. Elisa's mother suspects Ralph in her disappearance. He had been terrorizing her and her family that summer, but police are able to determine that Ralph was serving time in a Mexican prison when Elisa disappeared. Slowly, all the leads fizzle out and the case becomes cold. In 1993, 4 years after Elisa vanished, the family moved away from Aransas Pass.
We moved from Aransas in, I think it was 1993. We left the state because my mom just, She was still afraid. She didn't know if whoever took Elisa was going to come and hurt us. And so we didn't know, and we didn't talk to, we left under, you know, in the middle of the night. She didn't want anyone to know. We were instructed not to tell anybody, you know. Her church was helping us. And they said, because she said, I'm just so scared, I don't want Ralph to find me. And so we left, and don't ask me how we did this, but this was in the day where they must not have checked our ID, because we were flying and we went under assumed names. We didn't use her. I don't know. And the tickets were in these assumed names. So I don't know how this was pulled off. I really don't. So I don't know. But this is how secret this operation is. "Quote unquote operation was." She was terrified, and they were helping her get out for her protection and our safety. They moved us up here because they were from here. They're from this town, Idaho Falls, and they were it was a bishop and his wife, a Mormon bishop and his wife. At the time, we were Mormon, and so my mom had gone to them and said, I'm terrified, and I don't know what to do. I don't have any money. I don't have anywhere to go, but I need to leave. And that's when they said, okay, do you care where you go? Because, you know, and we didn't even know where we were going. We didn't know. We didn't know when we landed that we were in Idaho. We didn't know. They didn't want us to know because they were afraid we might say something or it might slip.
Right.
That's how secret that was.
Wow.
So that's why we ended up in Idaho Falls.
So, and it's okay if either you don't want to talk about this or maybe you don't even know, but was your mother's fear in 1993 to like move you all away, was that just fueled by the memories of Ralph, or had he started like stalking and intimidating her again after Elisa's disappearance?
She saw him. She saw him.
Oh,
he was back in town again. He had been gone for a while, and then she hadn't seen him since 1989, and then all of a sudden he was back in town. And so that's what triggered her fear when she saw him coming around.
In 1994, an H Progress picture of Elisa is generated and sent out via mailers all across the country. Her mother had this to say at the time, quote, "This will be a big help because that shows we're not giving up on her. I just keep hoping that one of these days, somebody who knows something will come out with some information. That way, if she's dead, I can put her to rest. And if she's alive, we can bring her home. Some people say I'm living in the past. I'm not living in the past. Elisa still is my child." End quote. The H Progress photo does generate some tips, about 60 from all across the country. However, only 13 of the tips contained enough information for the police to track them down. Police Captain Mike Thompson at the time said, quote, "Several calls were like, I saw this girl coming out of Kmart 6 months ago. How are you going to check it?" End quote. Some of the tips did turn up girls that looked a lot like Elisa, but further investigation all revealed not to be her. Every lead a dead end. The next big update comes in June of 2001, so Elisa has been missing for 11 years. And an anonymous letter is mailed to Chris TV.
They received a map, and somebody saying that this is where her remains are. I don't even have a lot of information. This part gets overlooked a lot. I don't have a lot of information on that if they followed up. I think they did follow up on it. And they looked in the area, but I never saw the map.
The envelope contained a map that was supposed to show the location of Elisa's remains. Police review the map and are able to recognize the location, but that's about it. Police Captain Mike Thompson said, quote, "We haven't been able to find anything that matches the area on the map. We would hope that whoever drew it would be more specific." End quote. Police never reveal the location mentioned on the map. And as far as I'm aware, there were never any digs as far as searching for remains in the location where the map was, besides just like a physical eyeball search of the area. Nothing more extensive than that. As the years drag on, the family will start to work more and more on Elisa's case themselves. The family is able to connect with a government investigator that volunteers his time and resources to the case.
So he was able to get some of the case files from the police department at the time, but they were heavily redacted.
Yeah.
And so very limited. And this is why we're suing the police department now, because we want the case files in their entirety. We don't want any redactions, but what by law has to be redacted, like, you know, social addresses, things like that.
Right.
So, and we believe if we can get in there to see certain things, There are things that then we can look at, we can focus on, we can then go down. Because honestly, it's really hard. It's really hard for, we get it. If a police department is short-staffed or if they're stuck in a loop and they can't, that's why we have people from the outside coming in trying to help. We get it. You know, people are, you know, police departments are short-staffed.
That's why they make, special units for just, the cold case homicides, and they put a couple of detectives over that and say, you guys are going to just focus on the cold cases, because it is a lot of time and effort, and on top of you doing your main job.
In 2016, Elisa has been missing for almost 27 years at this point, and there is a shift in the case. Police get a tip that leads them to bring in cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar to the home where the family lived on Whitney Street when Elisa went missing. The cadaver dog indicates at a spot, and the ground-penetrating radar finds an anomaly in the ground. Soil samples from the area are collected and sent off for testing. Almost overnight, the suspicion turns on the family.
When we went down in 2016, it was a witch hunt. They were coming after my mom. They made it very clear to my mom that they believe she killed Elisa. And they made it clear. There was no mistaken. Like, not only on top of everything that was put out on the news for everyone to know that they were searching our childhood home for remains. I mean, it was put out there. They also told this to us. They told me that I was covering for my mom, that I knew what happened, and that I needed to, it was time for me to come forward and to say what happened, and it's time for my mom to, to come clean.
The police get as far as saying they know where Elisa's remains are at. It's just a matter of logistics to get them.
What this tells me is, with everything that happened in 2016, they believe that my sister's remains are in our somewhere on the premises of our childhood home. They believe they've put that out there, but they do not want to move forward in what they need to do to recover those remains, because it would compromise the foundation of the home. We know her remains are not there, because we know what happened that day. She left our home that day. She left our home that day, and we never saw her again. They really want us to believe that when you find where you believe there is a body, the next natural step is then to recover the body. You don't sit on it for 8 years.
Rumors run rampant in the town.
And people were turning on us. As we're down there, all of a sudden you have people who are supporting you, who are your friends, and now all of a sudden they don't want to talk to you. They don't want to have anything to do with you. People who were my friends, like, all of a sudden I don't see them on my Facebook anymore. They've blocked me. And I couldn't understand, like, what on earth is going on?
Captain Rhodes tells Ruby that they also find bone fragments and tissue, and that an arrest would be coming within days.
They told me, Captain Rhodes told me, that they found what they believed to be bone fragments and tissue, and that they were going to be sending in these samples to be tested, and that they would be making an arrest within days. He told me this. And
in 2016?
Yes, he told me this.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yes, and my mom says, well, should I get an attorney? Because they're already making threats, they're going to arrest me. And I said,
yeah.
No. I was so naive. I said, no, Mom, they're just lying to us, Mom. They're just trying to get riled up. But you know what? People have gone to prison with less.
But the days come and go, and police never arrest anyone. Elisa's body is never recovered. The soil sample results are never released. And there has been no confirmation that the bone fragments and tissue ever existed or were ever tested and ID'd. In 2023 and 2024, Ruby and her family decide to put themselves back out there and begin pushing for answers in Elisa's case again.
And that's why in the last year we finally decided we need to take it into our own hands, because we're never going to get answers. They're never going to be open about it. They're never... So we have to do it, and we're going to have to do it. The only way we know how is to talk to the news, the media, and do my own stuff online, the podcasters. And I just started writing letters to anybody and everybody, every agency, every cold case agency, foundation for help. And finally, I think with all our pushing, we finally got the cold case missing persons unit with the attorney general's office now. now they have agreed to look into my sister's case. And so I think with all the pushing and the pressure, we finally, the police department finally decided to ask them to help and to give them the files.
There's also new leadership coming into the Aransas Pass Police Department as of 2025.
I think, you know, kind of my last question for you is just, you know, over this next year, what do you hope to see? Like, what would you like to see happen in your sister's case?
Oh, my gosh. Well, okay, so first, I know that now that the AG is, I know at some point they're going to reach out to us, so I'm excited for that because mm-hmm. now it's officially they're going to re-examine the case. And so I know two things can come out of this is, number one, once they're able to do their thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
do their report, I know that once they look at everything that was done, there's going to be vindication for my family. There's going to be, they're going to be able to say what the hell was all this, you know?
Right.
They're going to be able to say, you know, the family is not anywhere near being suspects. So
right.
I believe we're going to have that. But the most, again, no matter what, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what happened in 2016. Doesn't matter who said what, who hurt, who. At the end of the day, vindication is not even the main thing right now. You know, at the end of the day, it's bring resolution to my sister's case. And I have to remember that because as angry as I get and as much as I want vindication and as much as I want them to basically, you know, for lack of a better word, apologize to our family and just tell us once and for all, what did you find in 2016? That doesn't matter. None of that matters. None of that really matters at the end of the day. At the end of the day, it's bringing Elisa home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to step back to, and as much as I'm hurt and angry at all of this, you know, that happened in 2016, it just, our main thing, our main goal is finding Elisa, is bringing her home. I don't think that anybody will ever be held responsible for what happened to her. I don't think we'll ever find justice, but I hope that someday there's going to be a set of remains that somebody finds that they are able to match with Elisa's. That's how I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be by accident that
uh-huh.
a set of remains are found and that they do DNA testing and find it's Elisa. I truly don't believe that someone's going to come forward and say they know what happened. I just don't feel that, but I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's going to be a gotcha, we solved this case. I think it's going to be a by accident thing that her case is solved, or at least that her remains are found. We don't believe that it's ever going to be solved, quote unquote.
And that's where the case stands of today. If you know anything about the disappearance of Elisa Roberson in August of 1989, or her whereabouts today, please call the Aransas Pass Police Department at 361-758-5224. Or if you want to leave a tip online, you can use the Attorney General's online tip submission, which the link will be in our episode show notes. I just want to say thank you again so much for Ruby for her time. We talked for almost 3 hours the other day, but just a really incredible sister and an incredible advocate for her sister's case. She's really out here doing the heavy lifting, writing to podcasts, to foundations. So thank you so much again to Ruby for making time for me to chat with us about her sister's case. We will, of course, have pictures of Elisa on our Instagram. You can find us at Cold and Missing. And if you're not, please follow us there. You can stay up to date with all the cases that we cover. And if there's ever any reason that we can't bring you an episode 1 week, we'll always post an update there. Thank you so much to everyone who's rated and reviewed us in 2024. We appreciate it so much. Everyone makes me smile. And everyone helps get these cases out there. So if you have some time today in your podcast player, if you can rate us, review us, give us 5 stars, if you can leave us a written review in your podcast player, that helps so much. Other people finding the podcast, it helps boost the podcast and the algorithm, and ultimately it boosts the case that we're covering. So Thank you if you've done that. And if you haven't, today's a new day. It's a new year. Please do it if you have the time. And if you or someone you love is hard of hearing, we have our official transcripts on www.coldandmissing.com. We also have all our other episodes on there. So if you ever want to look back through our back catalog, it's all on there. But that's all I have for you this week. Next week, we'll kind of be back to our regular scheduled program. Eli will join us, and we'll just keep rolling through 2025. Thank you so much for listening to Cold and Missing. I'm your host, Allie. Have a good week and stay safe, y'all.